Taxation number 24198, Rule 2.
To what degree do you think there is a level of naivety in relation to you and going off to a fight a war?
At the time, I just thought, I'll get a trip overseas out of it and I'll see a lot of new places. I mightn't do as much fighting as what I thought, and things panned out a bit different, but still.
So, getting into the army, you're off to Northern Camp. Now, this is camp out in the country. Tell us about arriving in Northern Camp and what that was like.
We settled in pretty quick. Everyone seemed to think, well, the hardships might be there for a while, but we'll get used to it. The food was good. Training was heavy. We expected that. If you didn't expect it, well, you were a goat for enlisting to start with. You had to be trained. As a matter of fact, my specialist doctor that I go to, he's made a study of the war, and he reckons, in his opinion, the Australian soldiers that went to the Second World War must have been the fittest men that ever left Australia. That's what he thought.
Was that just due to the intensive training given?
I think so, yeah.
So when you arrived at Northern Camp, what were your initial impressions of the place? You're in the army now.
Yeah. Just huts. And I thought, well, it's a place to live. 3 meals a day. Hard training, I let myself in for, I expected it, and I seemed to take it all right.
Were you impressed by the camp?
Oh, yes, yeah. It was pretty well organised.
Tell us then the situation in relation to the training. What was involved in your average day's training?
Well, we'd be up at 6 o'clock in the morning. Six 6:30 we'd be out to do physical training, push-ups and skipping, running. Different things. Breakfast would be about 7:30. Then straight after breakfast was back onto the training ground. Could be a lecture by some officer. In the afternoon, could be a route march. Might only be 5 or 6 miles, and then back, and that was more or less your day.
What was the situation in relation to feeling like you were learning to be a soldier? What did it feel like?
To me, I felt a hell of a lot better than what I did when I was out of the army. Did feel more healthier kind of thing, I put it that way.
And in self-esteem, how did your self-esteem feel to be trained to be a soldier?
Well, I never brought that into it. I thought, well, what I do is my business, and if no one else wants to do it, well, that's their business.
But did learning to be a soldier make you feel better who you were for yourself?
No, I wouldn't say that.
Confidence?
No, no.
The period of the war between 1939, the opening of the war, through till May and June of 1940, had all been seen as a bit, it was a sort of quiet patch, particularly in relation to the British. And then obviously Dunkirk, May 28th. What was the feeling to know then who you were up against in relation to what had happened at Dunkirk?
Well, to be quite truthful, we thought that the average feeling was of talking to the blokes that Hitler couldn't be as good as what he'd boomed himself up to be, to leave the British Army in Dunkirk and instead of taking them all prisoner of war and taking them to different camps in Europe, he just left them there. And we thought it was a remarkable thing, all the little boats and everything of the people of Britain bringing them back over the Channel.
Was there ever a time when you thought, oh, Britain's finished, Britain's done?
Well, we thought they were in trouble. But we thought, well, it's only one facet of war, it's only one battle that they've lost, but once they get their army back in trim again, they'd be right, but that's one mistake he made, I think, by leaving them there to get back into it.
A lot of people say that they didn't join up until Dunkirk had fallen. Had you joined up by this point?
Oh, I don't think so.
To what degree do you think Dunkirk solidified your decision to join?
No, we thought, well, they were heavily outnumbered, that's what we thought, and it's just that they've retreated. You know, didn't think they were squibbed or anything, it was just that they were heavily outnumbered by German troops that they had to retreat.
Did it bring any realities home to you in relation to just how powerful the Germans were and how easy they'd been able to come through?
Yes, well, most of the countries that he... That's what I took a hatred of him, that most of the countries he finished up taking were all minor countries and would never have been a threat to him, in my opinion. But I think his the French Maginot Line at the time, we thought, well, that'll stop him. But it didn't. I reckon that was foolproof. He'd never get through there, but he just walked through it. He walked through Belgium and came round behind them. And I thought, well, how bloody silly they were to leave an opening like that for him. Still.
The general concern of the public. How would you rate the general concern of the public in around about this time?
Well, I think most public didn't talk about the war so much. You could get in a tram or something like that, and if someone started to bring up what was in the paper about so-and-so got killed the other day, and Oh, forget about that. We've got other things to do, kind of thing. But, we're a million miles away, and I think they just thought it was not going to affect us.
You're mentioning that a lot of your mates in the railways were saying, oh, don't be a fool, don't go away. The community, were there people that you knew that, or witnessed that were against the war?
No, I'd say there wasn't. I was surprised, as a matter of fact, that the day I went up for my medical, there were so many young chaps up there. The hall was full of them. There seemed to be hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them. At my age now, I'm the I've got a citation from our 2nd 28th Battalion that I am the first ex-prisoner of war nonagenarian inaugural nonagenarian ex-prisoner of war for the battalion. So I'd be the I wouldn't be the oldest bloke in the battalion, he's older than me, but they were not in Ruin Ridge. They never went into battle in Ruin Ridge. Could have been in the hospital or other duties or something. But that's one I class as an honour. I've turned 90, so... but I always went away to the war with the idea that there was no place on my uniform for bloody medals.
We can talk about that a little bit more later. But in relation to your training, you mentioned you're in Northern Camp, you were given a World War One rifle and a World War One bayonet.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing the ingenuity and that the Germans had things like Panzer tanks, did that concern you at all?
It did, yeah. Yeah. We only hope that... I think it made us think, well, America will have to eventually come into the bloody war and they'll have all the equipment in the world and we'll be right, but what we'd heard of the Panzer divisions and things like that made us think twice as to why we had enlisted.
Presumably you hadn't seen a tank in your training?
No, oh no. Never even knew what one looked like. Never saw a Tommy gun, boys' anti-tank rifle we used to have, which put your shoulder out of joint every time you fired it. That's all we had against the tank. And you can't find tanks with 1914-18 rifle and bayonet. It's impossible to fight them with them weapons.
The training in relation to possibly training against tank, were you given any sort of training against that?
No. Just keep your head down if you see them coming, but unless you came out of your foxhole, they just put the tread over and swiped it and filled it in on top of you, so you couldn't get away from them.
Okay, well, in relation to your training in Northern, how long were you to be involved with training there, do you think?
Oh, actually, forget me.
In relation to your training, how would you rate your fitness by the time you left?
Pretty good. I should say it was at least 6 months we were in Northern Camp.
What of your officers? Do you recall officers that stick out for you at the camp?
Yeah, a lot of nitwits from them.
Why would you say nitwits?
Well, it seemed to me that whoever picked them, they seemed to go for not men in the field or men that seemed to be training before they started. Our first officer worked in a bank as a teller. He went through an officer school. He never went through the ordinary ranks until he'd got a couple of pips on his shoulder. They seemed to go for the upper class kind of thing against the lower class. I think which was a big mistake.
Well, I'm interested to talk about that. How did it cause a rift, would you say, the fact that there was this class distinction?
We didn't. An officer had to be pretty good for us to have respect for him. If we thought he wasn't doing a good job, we just seemed to take a dislike to him straight away. We expected him to be an officer. That's what he was supposed to be. But some of them were very weak.
What did you look for then in an officer to be good?
A man that would go where he led you. He wouldn't say, "Well, you go in there, I'm not going in." That's the worst thing that ever happened. And he would do his share of all the hardships, the same as every ordinary soldier under his command. But some of them didn't work out that way at all.
Can we talk about you leaving Northern Camp and what it was like to leave Northern Camp after your training?
Well, we were excited because we knew we were going on the Queen Mary and what a great sea trip it would be, and at last we're going to see some action.
And you were involved in the 2nd 28th reinforcements.
Mm.
So the 2nd 28th as a battalion had gone on before you? Am I right?
The battalion itself? Oh yes, they were overseas while we were still in training in Northern Camp. That was 6 months in the siege of Tobruk.
Prior to your leaving, had you understood what was going on in relation to the war and how things were being fought?
No, we didn't get much information given to us.
Had you heard of the initial successes in the Western Desert in relation to the 6th Division and their success against the Italians?
Oh yes, we heard them, and the fall of Greece and paratroopers, the thing that we never thought of, paratroopers dropping in Greece. And
what was the feeling like knowing that you might end up having to combat things like paratroop drops?
Well, we weren't looking forward to it, to tell you the truth, because we knew that they must have some great gear and we had nothing. We never looked like getting anything.
So what would you say to the rating the morale on leaving Northern Camp, heading down to Fremantle to get on the Queen Mary?
Well, I think everyone was excited, that's what I'd say. They thought, oh well, different blokes would say, yeah, but look at all the gear they've got over there, or we'll handle that when we get there. In the meantime, this is a trip we've been looking forward to, going overseas, and then by that time they might have some gear that's pretty good, but didn't pan out that way for a long while.
So the trip on board the train coming down, was there much celebration?
Oh, no, it... we had people at different stations that had to wave us off, kind of thing.
What were your main topics of discussion amongst yourselves on board the train, do you think?
Glad to be out of Northern Camp would be one. We'd had enough of training, we reckon, which we had. Just general conversation and excitement.
Was there a discussion about the fact that you might not return?
Oh, yes, it didn't seem to worry most blokes. That say, oh, well, if my number's up, it's up. But if I might have a number on a bullet over there, and I'd say, oh, the same thing with me. But, I suppose it's only things that you think of that we hadn't seen action, and we were dying to get in and see what it was like, but half the time we were dying to get out of it too. But,
so there was this sort of conflict going on, do you think?
Yes, because we were... Reckon we always thought that we were fed to the wolves, as the saying is. They gave us nothing and expected it to do too much with it, and we couldn't do it.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about that later too. In relation to coming down to Fremantle, what was the atmosphere like on arrival?
Oh, pretty good. They kept all the people off the wharf, and I had a girlfriend at the time, and I told her where the train would go up onto the wharf, and I said, I'll come back and see if the fence had wire netting up and everything. And we left the train outside the wharf and came back and had a few kisses through the wire, and she wanted to get married before I left, but I didn't know it. Too much of a risk. So I finished up getting married when I come back.
Well, we can talk about that too, if you like. The atmosphere in relation to getting on board ship, leaving loved ones, obviously. Once you were on board, what was the feeling like?
Well, you had to forget everything that went on here, in my opinion, and look forward to what was coming or might be coming.
What were your initial impressions of the Queen Mary getting on board and your thoughts?
Oh, I thought, such a huge boat, how in the hell can this thing keep afloat? It's the biggest boat that's ever been built, in my opinion. We had one scare, about halfway to Ceylon, which is so Sri Lanka now. There was smoke seen on the horizon, and we had the HMAS Australia as our escort. There was three big boats of troops. The Empress of Canada was one, I forget the other one. Queen Mary. The flags went up to the masthead, and I said to one of the crew, I said, what are those flags telling you? Emergency. And to show you how big the ocean is, three big passenger liners like there were in our convoy, the Australia went over to see what the smoke was, and the three boats dispersed. And I suppose within 10 minutes, you could look all around the horizon and you couldn't see your other two boats anyway. They'd be in the same position as us. They just dispersed so quickly.
Your quarters on board ship, what were they like?
Oh, funny. Hammocks. I'd never slept in a hammock before. I don't think anyone else had. But all through the night, you'd hear, bloody bastard, someone finished up on the bloody floor. Dozens of them on the floor. Took us, must have been a week to get used to them. They're nice to sleep in, but I don't know, if you rolled over them, or you rolled out of the bloody hammocks somehow.
Where were you in on board ship?
Well, we were just above water because we had portholes. But when we were on kitchen duty, I said to the crew bloke one day, we had to get in and get potatoes. They used to peel them by the bag. I went down to get some potatoes and I said, we're under the water now, he said, we're right on the bottom of the water, mate. He said, the bloody ocean's not so far under us. He said, I forget what feet he gave me. He said, the water's up there. So it was a huge boat. But we still had to do our training on board the boat too. Run around the deck of the morning. PT. The tucker was good.
What was the average tucker on board the Queen Mary at this point?
Some meals were good, and some meals were bad. The officers, if you had we found out that if you had a good cook that had come out of a school and joined the army, and the officers would grab him, they would get him transferred from your kitchen, over to their kitchen. And any meal we didn't like, there must be thousands and thousands of plates and knives and forks in the bottom of the bloody ocean, Indian Ocean out there, because you'd open the porthole and throw your bloody plate and everything out with tucker on it. Must have cost them thousands of bloody pounds for cutlery.